All right, so we're gonna pick back up. Okay, so now we can actually, now we laid that background, we can get into the text of Exodus itself. All right, so we're gonna move through and get through first six chapters tonight. All right, kind of up to the plagues. Okay, is our plan. All right, so kind of first, again, we have this section, Israel and Egypt. First seven verses there is the plan continues, all right? And that's kind of what we established before, and we talked about the title of the book, right? That these are the names, is continuing the plan of Genesis, right? God is moving his plan forward, his agenda is continuing. And we see this even more so in verse 7, right? Notice there, it says, but the people of Israel were fruitful and increased greatly. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong so that the land was filled with them. And what does that make you think of, that terminology of being fruitful and increasing and filling the land or the earth? Genesis, more specific, because we just covered Genesis. Yeah, Noah, like creation, right? Genesis 1, foundationally, right? This shows again that God is moving his plan to bring people back to this original creation, right? This plan is not lost. It's moving forward. And then as some others mentioned, right, these promises were also, these blessings were repeated with like the Noahic covenant, the Abrahamic covenant, right? It's again showing that this is all moving forward, right? It is through the nation of Israel that God is moving this plan forward, that we are heading back to creation, all right? This original creation, okay? But as you would expect, there is some opposition to this plan, okay, which we see kind of through the remainder of chapter 1, that we see this God's plan being challenged, essentially, right? Where there's now opposition that's trying to oppose this, trying to stop it, by primarily trying to stop the Israelites from growing, okay, and all that. And that comes through Pharaoh, right? And what does he start out by doing? You guys remember? To oppress them? What's he do?
Make them work harder.
Yeah, essentially makes them their slaves, right? He makes them their slaves, and he starts building these cities, doing all this stuff, right? Essentially enslaves them, okay? Oppresses them in that way. But notice in verse 12 what happens as a result of this. It says, verse 12, but the more they were oppressed, what happened? The more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad, right? This is God, as we've seen before, turning evil into good, right? That God's plan is not thwarted, right? It's not kind of derailed, okay? But rather, it's still moving forward, right? Despite what Pharaoh's growing, I'm sure he didn't expect that, right? Hey, we got this plan, it's going to move forward, we're going to do this. And then suddenly they just keep growing and multiplying. You're like, what's happening, right? It's because what? God is at work. He is moving his plan forward, okay? But Pharaoh doesn't just kind of quit very quickly, all right? Because he hatches another plan, right? Do you guys remember what his next plan was to try to stop this moving forward? Yeah, kill all the baby boys, right? Infanticide, essentially, right? And he recruits, if you remember, the Hebrew midwives, saying like, hey, whenever you go and serve as a midwife, if a baby boy is born, kill him, right? And do you remember, do they kind of go through with that? No, right? They don't. And so Pharaoh summons them, right? Asking like, why have you done this? Why have you let them live? And what do they say? Like in verse 19, right? Listen to this explanation. It's pretty great, all right? It says, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. Kind of like a quick little insult there, all right? They're not like them because what? For they are vigorous and give birth. Like, they're strong. Your Egyptian women are weak, okay? They're strong, they're vigorous, and they give birth before the midwife comes to them, okay? And so then the question kind of arises, some people bring up, like, were they lying, right? Were they lying? Is that just a straight-up lie or what? And I would argue, right, that they actually weren't lying, okay? That you see in the context, right, that God is multiplying his people, having them grow, right? It's essentially this him against Pharaoh type of thing, and he's showing to Pharaoh, like, in every way, I am winning, I'm doing better, right? And so, and then the grammar of verse 20, if you look at that verse where it says, so God dealt with well with them, dealt well with the midwives, that's so there. Kind of in the Hebrew grammar, right, has this idea of a concluding sentence, right? This is a concluding. This isn't like about to so as in he's giving results. It's more of kind of like in this way God dealt with, kind of like well with them, essentially summarizing what has come before. That essentially what the midwives said happened, God actually did, right? He actually made it so that the Hebrew women were giving birth before the midwives could get to them, right? And we don't know if they like took their time getting to them or not. It's like, this person's giving birth. Okay, let me grab my stuff. Grab my stuff. I don't know. We don't know that. But we do know essentially from this that what? They weren't lying. They're telling the truth of, hey, they give birth before we even get there, right? And it's because of who? God, right? It's because he is at work there, okay? Working this out, making this happen, okay? And so again, and look at the last part of verse 20, what's the result? And the or the concluding thought there as well, right? Is, and the people what? Multiplied and grew very strong. So Pharaoh's kind of 0 for 2, right? Keeps trying to stop this, to kind of inhibit God's plan, but what? It keeps moving forward. Israel keeps prospering because of God, right? That's the only thing that makes sense, right? If you have a Pharaoh in control kind of doing this, you would expect it to work, but it doesn't because God is working behind it, right? He's the one orchestrating all of it for his purpose, all right? And so Pharaoh, again, he's pretty like, he wants it stubborn. He wants to keep going, right? Where he, even though he can't control kind of Israel, what? He then turns to his own people in verse 22. And what does he tell them to do? Every son you find, do what? Yeah, throw him in the Nile, right? Throw him in the Nile River, okay? And so he turns to his people. And we'll see kind of in chapter 2, that doesn't go so well either, okay, for his plan. Okay? So that's what's happening in chapter 1, right? God's plan is moving forward. It's being challenged, right? But it's still moving forward. And this leads into chapter 2, where we see God raises up a deliverer. All right? God raises up a deliverer. Okay? This is the one who he will use to bring the people out of Egypt, which I'm sure you know is who? Moses. All right? Good. All right? And so, and just kind of quick side note with this, with kind of Moses being born in the midst of kind of this infanticide happening, right, where babies are being killed and all that, can you think of another person who was born in a similar situation where baby boys were being killed? Jesus, right? And then the question is, oh, that's a nice coincidence. Like, it's like, no, right? There's a reason, right? And essentially, the purpose behind that is what? To show that Jesus is like the new Moses, right? And we see in the New Testament, right, that there is this talk of like a new Exodus, so to speak, kind of thing. Like there's another Exodus. And so in the same way that Moses was the leader of the first Exodus, what, Jesus is going to be the leader of kind of the new Exodus, right? That's what his birth even proclaims, right? So again, it's not accidental, right? When you see those connections, you shouldn't just think, oh, that's kind of interesting, and move on, right? It's kind of think through why. What? Why is this happening? Okay, God doesn't do accidents, right? It's purposeful. Okay, and so that's just for that. All right, so we see kind of a man of the tribe of Levi and his wife, also from the tribe of Levi, have a son, Moses, right? Hide him for a while till they can't hide him anymore. And then it says that she makes a basket and sets him in the Nile. Something to point out there, you see the word basket there? That's not the normal term used for basket in scripture. Okay, it's actually the same term used for ark, like as in Noah's ark. Okay, and it wasn't like, yeah, don't get the picture of like she built this ginormous thing and like just put a little baby in it. Like, I want to be safe. I don't know, like the ultimate mom care or something, right? It's not that idea. But why does Moses, right, remember he's the one writing it, describe it in that way? To make the connection back to Noah, right? to essentially show, just as God used Noah as kind of this way, this delivered through the flood, right, is what? This one is going to be that next deliverer. He's going to be the same deliverer. This is the one who's going to be the designated deliverer for the people. Okay? All right? Moses will be used in the same way. So she places him in the basket of the Nile, and then who finds him? Yeah, Pharaoh's daughter, which is, yeah, Hatshepsut, yeah. I get the consonants all mixed up and everything. Hatshepsut, okay. She finds him, and she recognizes this is one of the Hebrew's children, right, which makes it clear that she kind of knows what she's doing, right? She's disobeying whose orders? Her dad's, right? Which, again, ironically kind of goes against where Pharaoh's trying everything he can, right? Where he tried the midwives, that didn't work. Then he says, tells all his people, hey, throw them all in the Nile, do this. And who disobeys? His own daughter, right? And even more ironic, the person she saves is eventually the person who what? Like leads kind of like to Egypt's destruction, right? Kind of the bit huge irony there, okay? The guy who's going to lead to kind of the downfall of Egypt, okay? And so we see the Lord raising him up, okay? And so Moses grows up, okay, as we've seen, kind of is raised in kind of a royal household, okay, as we talked about before. And we have later on in his life, one day he goes out to look upon his people and the burden they're happening and sees an Egyptian beating one of the Hebrews. And what does he do? Kills him, right? Kind of looks around, doesn't see anyone, kills him, okay? And then the next day he goes back out again, sees a couple guys arguing, tries to be the mediator between them, and they say, what? Who are you? You're not going to rule over us, right? And then are you going to kill us like you killed that other guy? And he realizes, uh-oh, people know, right? and so then he flees, okay? He flees. And what we start to see, right, that he is this appointed deliverer, right? He's going to be this appointed deliverer. But just like we saw with like Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, were any of them like ready to go right when God first called them? Were they like super mature right away? No, they all needed growth, right? And Moses in the same way, right? Moses in the same way. And right now, it seems like his kind of struggle is kind of taking things like into his own hands, right? Where it's like, I'm going to be the deliverer, and what? He like kills a dude. Not a good plan, right? Not a good idea. Okay? And so we're going to see God growing him in that way, humbling him through this time where he flees, right? Where he's essentially kind of in an exile of sorts, okay? So he goes to the land of Midian, meets eventually his future wife there, and all that. And notice in verse 22, they give birth to a son, and they name him Gershom, all right? Which he says, I have been a sojourner in a foreign land. Essentially, like Gershom comes from the word for sojourner in Hebrew. Okay, and so essentially, Moses is starting to recognize, like starting to be humbled a little bit. I'm just, what, a sojourner. I don't belong here, whether that's in Midian or he might also be thinking in Egypt as well. He might be realizing we need to go back to the land, right? But he's recognizing, I'm just a sojourner, right? He's starting to be humbled a little bit, okay? All right. And then the end of chapter 2, we see God hears his people. And these few verses, right, are actually pretty cool, all right? We see it cuts back, right? 23, during those many days, the king of Egypt died. Okay, that would have been Thutmose the III, okay, if you're keeping track of that, the guy who wanted to kill Moses. Okay, he dies. So his son Amenhotep II is now in control. Okay, but it talks about the people of Israel groaning because of their slavery, right? And most translations, I don't know if your guys' translations say, but it mentions like, and they cried out for help, or their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God. Do you guys have something like that in your? Okay. So in Hebrew, there is actually no mention of those concepts of for help or for rescue. It's literally just they cried out and their cry from slavery came up to God, right? And that's significant because why? Because they weren't necessarily even asking for God to necessarily help them, Okay, they were crying out from their pain, right? The emphasis is on their pain from the slavery. Okay, and maybe they were crying out to God, but what Scripture here indicates that they were just crying out because of the pain, right? But what ends up happening? God hears their groaning, God remembers, and he's going to intervene, right? And really this amplifies God's response, right? To show that even when they didn't ask, God still cared, right? God still cared for his people, even when they didn't ask necessarily for him to intervene and help, he still is going to, right? Which is pretty profound in its own way, right? Where even sometimes when we don't ask, like, God cares, right? He still works, okay? But we see God remembers his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, with Jacob, okay? And remember that idea of remembering is not like, oh, I forgot about that. Here we go, okay? It's more of that now when he remembers, it's this focused attention that he's going to act, especially like he's going to be faithful to, like, say, his covenant relationship, okay? That's that idea of remembering. That's what he's doing. And so we see that he remembers, and in verse 25 it says, God saw the people of Israel, and God knew, right? Which emphasizes kind of his relationship with them, okay? And so God is going to intervene, right? He's going to step in and intervene here, okay? And that leads into chapter 3, which then makes sense, where we have the call of Moses, right? Where God calls Moses to be this deliverer, right? To be this one, to go to Pharaoh and all that, okay? So he's raising up this deliverer. And so there's a lot in this chapter. We don't have time to go through all the details of it, but we'll point out a couple of things here. And so we see the Lord calling Moses. This is like the story of the burning bush, right? Where Moses kind of looks and sees it. He's like, that seems pretty cool. I'm going to go check it out, right? Goes over there, and then the Lord speaks to him from out of the bush, okay? Essentially telling him, like, I'm the God of your father. I'm going to bring the people out of Egypt, kind of all that stuff. But is Moses, like, again, is he, like, really gung-ho to kind of go along with this? No. He has his doubts, right? He has his doubts. He's not sure what will happen, okay? He even says, like, in verse 11, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children out of Egypt? So essentially, Moses kind of swung the pendulum to the opposite side, where before it's like, I'm going to take things into my own hands, all right? To now he's like, I'm kind of worthless, useless, right? And it's, okay, that's not what being humble, right, is not that, because what? He's not trusting who? God, right? His attention is still on himself, right? He needs to learn to put his focus on the Lord, not himself, right? But to trust what the Lord is doing, okay? And we see God says, I'll give you a sign that I'll be with you. Which is kind of an interesting sign, right? In verse 12, where he says, when you, like, I'll send you, and then when you've brought the people out of Egypt and you return to this mountain, then you'll know that I am with you. You're kind of like, that's kind of weird. It's like after the fact, right? But what? His point is that he's emphasizing to Moses, like, you need to trust me, right? It's his point is, I'm going to be with you. Okay, and when you get to this point, when you come back here after Egypt, you'll recognize God was with me the whole time, and I should have been looking to him the whole time. Right? That's what's going on. Okay? But again, Moses still kind of has his doubts, right? And so he asks, like, well, who do I say sent me, right? What's your name that I can tell these people if they ask, right? And this is where, again, we see this theme of God revealing his name to his people. And in verse 14, what's he say to Moses? What's he say as his name? I am who I am, right? I am who I am. Very significant phrase there, okay? That in this phrase, we see both kind of the transcendence of God as well as the fact that he is personal and relational, okay? And I'll kind of flesh that out, right? What we see from this phrase is the only really true way to describe, like, to describe God is what? That he is God. He's like, I am who I am, right? Like, there's no other way to kind of describe me, right? And this is essentially showing his transcendence, right? Meaning that he is completely, like, other than, like, us, right? He is above us, superior to us, okay? And we often, when we talk about defining God, right, we often whenever we try to do so, we normally are kind of only describing part of God, right? We can say God is loving, which that's true, but is that all of who God is? No, right? There's much more to him than that. And so even when we try to describe him, there's limitations. And so the only fitting definition of to incorporate of who God is what? He's God. That's just what it is. And that's what this phrase is showing. Okay, and this is so crucial because so often we can kind of view God as just like kind of like a better version of us, right? He's like a little bit better than us. Kind of similar, but he's like better. Okay, but what this is showing is what? He's categorically different than us. He is God. There is none like him. There is no other way to describe him, even in our vocabulary, except for the fact that he is God. That's who he is, right? That is showing his transcendence, his superiority over all things, okay? But in the fact that he is revealing himself to his people, right, shows that he is also a relational God, that even though he is this transcendent, superior God, he also cares for his people and wants this relationship with them and reveals his personal name to them, right? And we see that all wrapped up in that little phrase, I am who I am, right? And we see, and this name actually ties in with a little bit of what he's going to do later on with like the Exodus and all that. It's going to tie into him being a redeemer, right? And in verse 15, he talks about how, and it is by this name I am going to be remembered throughout all the generations, right? This is the name that is going to be remembered, right? So then the rest of chapter 3, God kind of gives Moses the plan of what's going to happen, right? He's going to send them to Pharaoh, all that, bring the people back, and all that, right? Does his plan. But still again, chapter 4, Moses still has his doubts, right? Still has his doubts, right? He questions, what if the people don't believe me, right? What if they don't believe me when I come to them, right? And God gives them kind of a few signs, right, that he can do. Do you remember the first one? He tells him to do what? Yeah, throw the staff on the ground, turns into a serpent, right? Which is kind of hilarious. I don't know, I always laugh at this part in verse 3, right? He does it, and then Moses, like, runs off, right? That's what he talks about. Where, because I think, yeah, right? The Lord just tells him, like, throw it on the ground. He doesn't tell him what's going to happen, right? Just, hey, throw it on the ground. That'd be pretty frightening, right? He just runs off, right? But then, so you have that. We have him, like, put his hand in his cloak, take it out. It's, like, leprous, put it back, it's gone, right? That kind of thing. As well as then the ability, right, to turn water into blood, right? Yeah, blood. And so we have God giving him these signs, right, to help him in that, okay? But then even in verse 10, right, we again continue to see Moses kind of somewhat reluctant, right? And he says what? Like, I am slow of speech and of tongue. Like, how can I be the one to speak all these things, right? Which ironically people point out, this Hebrew sentence is a very eloquent sentence, actually, in Hebrew. And so it's like, yeah, right, right, like, you're good, okay? But, right, it's showing that he is still has his doubts, and God still is kind with this and provides who? Aaron, to be kind of his spokesman, right, his mouthpiece type of thing, okay? So we see that unfolding, all right? So Moses is still learning, right? He's still learning, still growing to trust the Lord in this. Okay, but he starts to head back to Egypt. Okay, heads back to Egypt, starting to head that direction. Okay, and again, in verse 21 through 23, you kind of have the Lord reminding Moses of kind of the plan. All right, but notice something important here, right? When he says, when you go back to Egypt, see that you do before Pharaoh all the miracles that I put in your power, but I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. Okay, and real quick, just want to touch on that idea of God hardening Pharaoh's heart, because sometimes people can read that and they're like, well, that's not fair, right? Like, God's kind of hardening his heart. Why is Pharaoh kind of responsible for that? Maybe you've heard that train of thought, right? Especially like in Romans 9, this gets brought up as well, because Paul's alluding to like Exodus, okay? And it's kind of like, well, how's that fair? If God hardens people's hearts, what's going on with that? And so to explain that, you have to understand, like, we in English have kind of the one word hardens, okay? Like that's used all throughout Exodus. But in Hebrew, there's like three different words that are used throughout that all have like a slightly different emphasis, okay? And so the first way is more the idea of like strengthening someone or something, right? The idea of strengthening. And so when we often think of God hardening Pharaoh's heart, we often think of it in the sense of Pharaoh wanted to let the people go, and God like changed his heart or whatever so that he wouldn't, right? But what the Hebrew term like carries the idea when it talks about strengthening is it's taking, right, something that someone always wanted to do and just giving them the strength to do it, right? That's the idea of God hardening his heart, right? It's not that Pharaoh's like, I really want to let them go, but God won't let me kind of a thing, right? It's no, Pharaoh always wanted to not let them go, and God is just giving him the strength to kind of like go through with it, all right? Does that make sense? Okay? So he's not necessarily going against what Pharaoh wanted, okay? Second, the term is also used in the sense of kind of making someone like dull or dumb type of thing, where essentially like they don't see what's obviously kind of before them, right? Which again, you can see throughout the book of Exodus with Pharaoh, with all the plagues going on, all the miracles, like even his like advisors are like, okay, you need to stop, like look at this. And he's like, no, we're still going, right? Like, I got this. And so you can see it's used in that kind of way. Right. And then the last way, when it's used of Pharaoh, like hardening his own heart. Right. That means that's referring to like his resolve to resist change. Right. His resolve to resist any sort of change. Right. He is set in his ways. OK. And so this all kind of shows, right, like God isn't necessarily doing anything like wrong. Right. He's not doing anything like ethically questionable or something like that, right? But rather, what? He's giving Pharaoh the strength to do what Pharaoh wanted to do all along, right? And so you can kind of see the connection there. Like I mentioned before, that Paul picks this up in Romans 9 when he talks about people not believing the gospel and stuff. If someone doesn't want to believe the gospel and God gives them the strength to like not believe it, is God doing anything wrong? No, right? He's just helping them to do what they want to do. And that's essentially Paul's point, right, in Romans 9, okay? God is not, like, keeping someone safe from, like, believing the gospel. It's like, I really want to believe, but God won't let me. It's like, no, they never wanted to in the first place, and God is strengthening them to do so, okay, if that makes sense. And that's what's happening here with this idea of God hardening Pharaoh's heart, all right? Okay. So we have a couple more. Real quick, I just want to touch on these verses because they're weird and you've probably read them and you're like, what is going on? Okay. The next few verses, verses 24 to 26. I don't know if you guys have encountered this, these verses. If you read through Exodus, we're like, this is kind of bizarre, right? As he's heading back to Egypt, you see the Lord, kind of meets Moses and it says he sought to put him to death. You're like, well, that's weird. I thought they were good. Okay. And then it says, verse 25, then Zipporah, which is Moses' wife, took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin and touched Moses' feet with it and said, surely you are a bridegroom of blood to me. So he, like God, let him alone. It was then that she said a bridegroom of blood because of the circumcision. And then it just kind of moves on. You're like, what in the world is happening? Right? Like, what is going on? Right? And I've always kind of like wondered that. And like kind of the best explanation I've heard, which I think makes sense, right, is right before those verses, right, you have the Lord talking to Moses, telling him how he needs to go to Pharaoh and tell Pharaoh what? Let my son go. Let my son, Israel, like go to serve me, right? Essentially telling Pharaoh, stop keeping my people from having like a relationship with me, essentially, right? Stop keeping my people from me, right? And so kind of the best explanation I've heard of this other thing is that Moses, by not circumcising his son, right, which was according to like the Abrahamic covenant, they're supposed to do that, right? By not doing that was keeping his son from what? Having this covenant relationship with God. And so in a sense he was acting the same way as who? Pharaoh. And so essentially God is saying, stop acting like Pharaoh and act like the covenant leader you're supposed to be. Don't be essentially like a hypocrite. Right? By telling Pharaoh, hey, let my people go to have this relationship while you're keeping your son from having that same relationship. Right? Does that make sense? Right? That's kind of what's happening there. In a kind of bizarre event. But that's what's going on, right? And so we see kind of the seriousness where God is instructing Moses to be the covenant leader he is supposed to be. Right? And it starts kind of with his own son, right? All right. So he meets up with Aaron, and then we're into chapter 5, all right, where we see the showdown begins, all right, the showdown between Pharaoh and the Lord, all right, starts to begin kind of here in chapter 5, where Moses and Aaron, they go to Pharaoh, and they have that common phrase, right, thus says the Lord, what, let my people go, essentially, right? And then you have kind of Pharaoh laying down the challenge, right? In verse 2 with his response. But it says, Pharaoh said, what? Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord. And moreover, I will not let Israel go. Essentially, he's like, the Lord, I don't know him. Like, and in his mind, right? And in Egyptian kind of religion, like Pharaoh was considered a god as well, right? He's like, I'm like the god around here. What are you talking about? I don't know this Lord. I'm not going to obey him. I'm not going to listen to him. Okay? Essentially, the challenge has been set, right? The showdown is beginning. And to emphasize this, right, notice in verse 10 what the word of the taskmasters to the people says. Notice it says what? Thus says Pharaoh, right? The same phrase that Moses and Aaron came to Pharaoh and said, thus says the Lord. Now what? Pharaoh is like, I could do that too. Thus says Pharaoh. What? You're going to have like no straw. He's going to make labor even harder. Right? You come to me saying your God says this. Well, guess what? I'm saying this. All right? This challenge has started. Right? This showdown has begun. Okay? And so we see in chapter 5, the result, right, is that the labor increases. Right? The people have to now gather their own straw to make the bricks for all these cities and stuff and meet the same quota as they did before. And that leads to the people kind of complaining about it, right? To Moses and Aaron, which leads to Moses then at the end of chapter 5, like, Lord, what's going on, right? And you have in chapter 6, God essentially saying to Moses, this is all part of the plan. Told you, right? Like, this is all happening. It's okay. And he gives him assurance, right? That this is all part of the plan. Going to be okay. And notice especially in verse 3, right? Significant to our theme of names, right? Where he says, or starting in verse 2, he says, I am the Lord. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as God Almighty, but by my name, the Lord, which is like Yahweh, okay, I did not make myself known to them, right? This doesn't necessarily mean that they didn't know the name Yahweh, because we see that actually happening in Genesis, okay? But it means what? That he didn't reveal the full nature of what that name entailed, right? What that name encompassed, right? Which essentially we're going to see is what? A God who redeems, right? Who acts on behalf of his people to redeem, like we're going to see in the Exodus, okay? That God is saying, I didn't reveal myself in that way to like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but now you're going to see kind of who I am. Right? And that's what we're talking about, God revealing his name to his people. Okay? So God assures Moses, tells him, the plan is still going, it's fine. Okay? And then lastly, chapter 6 wraps up with a genealogy of Moses and Aaron. Okay? Talking about the tribe of Levi, which that's significant because the tribe of Levi, they eventually become the what of Israel?
Priests.
Right? And so essentially, this seems to be kind of why they mention this here, is to kind of legitimize probably Moses and Aaron, because they're kind of acting as priests in a sense, right? Where they're these mediators between the people and God, and showing that this is all part of the plan, as well as anticipating this priestly line later on, okay? And that takes us into chapter 7, which we'll pick up next time with the plagues. All right, and we'll wrap up the book of Exodus as well, all right?